Sandra, and Noah.
Hello, and
hi, everyone.
Welcome to the Theater World Podcast.
Here we are again.
I'm Noah Bender.
And I'm Sandra Nemchek.
And today, our guest this week is a performer, director, divisor, and teacher, the founder of the Naked Empire Buffon Company in San Francisco, and professor of acting and directing physical comedy at Emerson College. Please welcome Natty Justiniano.
Hello,
hey.
Hello.
Hey. Welcome. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So excited to have you on.
Likewise.
You are our first guest who is outside the realm of musical theater.
Aha.
No pressure at all. None.
none. I mean, I've dabbled, teeny tiny dabbling. So maybe if I have to reference that, I will.
Ooh.
We don't have to talk about Broadway. We don't have to talk about any of that.
We don't have to. Yeah. We are a theater-based.
Sweet.
Yeah, like, and I want to get into talking more about, you know, different modes of theater with different people. And I think you're a good place to start because your work is in physical acting, clowning, Buffon, Shakespeare even.
Yeah.
But let's just start. Your big main thing is Buffon. And probably most people out there have never seen Buffon or don't really know what it is. Can you give us a basic just definition of the art of Buffon?
Yeah. It is traditionally, or originally maybe, derived from a street theater performance tradition, European street theater performance tradition of mocking societal stuff, the nastiness of society that we're all avoiding and not talking about, and making great big fun and sport of it in order to sometimes like diffuse it or highlight it. Like it can really be attached to a lineage of satire and also have a really good time doing it. It could get really gritty and grotesque, and that's one of the reasons I like it.
It seems like it can be really cathartic.
I think so. And it's funny that you use that word specifically because my teacher talked about it being on the same coin on the flip side of tragedy, which is where we get the word catharsis, that release. That both tragedy and Buffon look at societal structure and challenge it. And at the end, you're having that release or realization or opening to new possibilities as a part of the work. Yeah.
I just imagine it at like Notre Dame, inside Notre Dame during the French Revolution. That's what I'm thinking of. I'm like, yeah, is that what they did then?
Yeah, there's one strain of training that comes from this teacher named Philippe Goulier, who is Sacha Baron Cohen's teacher. And he tells a story about Buffon's origins being somewhere in the Middle Ages with the hunchbacks being kicked out of the village and, you know, getting that whole hunchback of Notre Dame imagery, coming back into the village for one day a year to do the Feast of Fools and make fun of, be king for the day. And talk about the taxes and the wars, and then the king goes back to his castle, looks at himself in the mirror, and then kills himself. And that's the ideal. you know, the powerful seeing themselves and how much they contribute to societal ills. My teacher, but my teacher went back before that, didn't think of the Middle Ages as the starting point for this tradition. It goes even further than that, where we get the word satires from satyrs, a half man, half goats in the Greek times, and then even before that, this notion of telling a story and having fun and play when we tell the stories of the maybe the hardest aspects of life, say like the hunt or just trying to survive the seasons or whatever, really ancient storytelling. That sort of sentiment is attached to the joy of doing Buffon.
And you're right, like the comedies in ancient Greece all held mirrors to every single, you know, political thing that went on. That's how you could tell, like, are you doing a good job or aren't you?
Yeah, they were a good barometer, the theater, for what was going on.
And what makes Buffon so... Buffon is just... It's meant to be shocking. It's... Or you're twisting your head at that. Do you disagree?
No, it's inclusive of. So I think the practice is... there's a guy named Jacques Lecoq. He was a teacher. And Goulier, who I just mentioned, used to teach at his school. When he talked about Buffon and wrote about it, he said it was the broadest realm of like style, like this red nosed clown and Buffon and this tragedy and all these commedia. And by broadest, it could be something like not funny, not comedy, not even speaking English, sort of weird creatures, all the way to something like Sacha Baron Cohen's Borat, which is photorealistic, real person, real speaking English. So the realm could be lots of different things. It could be really performance arty. My particular strain of it, the part that I'm attracted to, is using shock in order to sort of disarm some of the shame.
Yeah, the word I was looking for was disarming.
Yeah, I'm into that as a function, but there's folks that are practicing it that don't prioritize satire, that don't prioritize even comedy, and it's still a version of Buffon.
Because, yeah, like, I mean, no offense, but your Buffon is pretty grotesque.
Oh, that's a compliment. That's what.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what the word the
yeah,
work
the,
is.
The one scene that I watched, I remember, was the one you were like talking about somebody bleeding in the face, but there was no blood at all, and you're like, look at all the blood, look at all the blood, and I was like, that's so interesting that, like, you know, you're saying look at all the blood, the audience, but they can obviously not see anything. So like, is that like something like, as if you can say it enough, then can you talk them into seeing it and being like grossed out? I don't know. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think, well, I would have to zoom out for that question.
Yeah.
I think, and this goes along with a lot of puppetry and a lot of metaphoric or visually driven theater work, is that humans, I believe, want, when they go to the theater or when they go to, I don't know, art, want to imagine stuff with you. And so there's a lot of real engagement and willingness from fellow humans to just, if you say something, if you suggest something, they'll go with you on it. So we could just say things and then, I don't know, believe in it or play it like little kids,
so
playing
it's
anything.
Play, yeah.
Pretend, and audiences will go with you and also kind of imagine it in its worstness.
Pulling people up to and past their own limits.
They can see it with the scope, you know, different areas.
Love it.
Can you describe the process of becoming like inhuman for Buffon? Because it's in terms of movement style and the way that you kind of theorize your character, it's far from the realm of, you know, walking on 2 feet in kind of normal life.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm evolving on this. So Lecoq is a French dude. He's in Paris. He's a white guy. I'm sure he was straight. You know, started exploring this form somewhere in the 70s. It's not politically thoughtful or intentional or inclusive. So the beginning of this form and the majority of the practice in my own practice is to puff up. Buffare is an Italian derivation of to be larger and to exaggerate. And so the way in was often to exaggerate things that you personally might be ashamed to highlight, because Buffons are shameless. Let's do an inversion of that. So, you know, people are making their teeth even yellower. If they are ashamed of their lankiness, they're making themselves lankier. If they have a big fat anything, they're going to make it fatter, whatever it is. And to like dance around and make it, they think they're beautiful and they know they're beautiful and they don't give a fuck about you and all that. Let's talk about cussing on this podcast. And so,
go for it.
Okay, great. Good. And so that's the training, and it's really, to bring that word back, cathartic for students to learn it for the first time and have that sort of freedom. Mm-hmm. However, I really want to emphasize this: there is no control over what an audience is actually laughing at. So although the content and the intention and the people involved, and even the structure of the jokes that we create is not pointing at, say, fatness as the joke, I can't help if a good chunk of that audience is laughing at jiggling fat. Mm-hmm. So I was asked by a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, a really wonderfully pointed question that I've been wrestling with since, and that is, how is Buffon not a form of minstrelsy of fatness and disability? And that I don't think any current teachers are answering. And so my company, in the last two shows, we've been shifting away from the kind of exaggerated, grotesque body body morphing into asking ourselves, what was the initial function of that? Part of it is spectacle. We want to be in newspapers whenever we do a show, and we always have these great images.
It's definitely eye-catching.
Yeah. And we also want to have othering and some element of otherness so that there's some theatrical distancing, so, which allows somehow the creature to say and do more cutting material than if they just looked like a regular pedestrian human. So now the last show we did, we based it off of Baba Yaga the Witch because it's based off of the actor's own heritage and own family tradition. And then recently we were doing an anti-colonial piece about the Puerto Rican diaspora, and we used life jackets and blue tarps, which are still covered covering the island, as these exaggerated big costumes, more in the vein of Machine Dazzle's work with Taylor Mack, so to go really, really large, really big, really fabulous to look at, and using it in the same sort of way to have a full body puppet kind of action. Still has the same function, but it's not some kind of mockery of amputation or dirtiness or disability or fatness.
Because, yeah, to me, it seems like kind of akin to the a conversation along the lines of drag performance.
Yeah.
Where.
Yes, I'm with you.
Some people see the performance of femininity as stereotyping or harmful, or, you know, for you know, for men.
That comes up.
And, but, you know, there's also the other side of, you know, for drag performers, a lot of that accentuation and heightening of the feminine body and the feminine, you know, aura, etc., is the most freeing for them because it's the things that they've had to repress within themselves. Or
it makes them feel beautiful, you know, like they want bigger hips and bigger boobs, and they don't have that.
Sure, and it's also not monolithic. So I've actually had students in my workshops, and I teach these workshops all over North America. And I've had people in wheelchairs. I've had an actual amputee. I've had different body types. And I've never received direct feedback that this is harmful. Even from my audiences, I haven't heard that. However, I loved being asked the question because I, of course, I'm always trying to evolve the work to be as in alignment with my own values as possible.
Yeah, it's a worthy consideration.
Of course it is. Of course, of course. And so that's where this new sort of attempt to reconcile the potential harm of the work and my own values and my own aesthetic desires all together.
Yeah, if we aren't a person morphing and changing, then what are we, you know?
Yeah, precisely. Love that.
Yeah, and if we don't get to point out these things about ourselves that we may feel insecure about, or things that are very noticeable to the rest of the world that we ought to be able to take full power of on our own, on our own version, our own schedule, our own image.
Yeah.
Love it. I want to take you back a little bit. Like, what really drew you to clowning as a child or as a teen? Like, where did it really all start?
None of that. I'm a theater kid. My training is in capital A acting, and I did drama. I never improv'd and never did comedy. I thought it was a lesser form, and if someone went up on their lines in a show, I would sit there and wait for you to be a professional, because I am not doing that, you know. I was arrogant and snooty and very, very, very good. I played Hamlet, all the things. So and then I went to grad school and came out as an improv comedy making machine. And actually, the clown training in my grad school experience did not go well. It's very humbling and very, very, very challenging. I didn't go to that school for clown. I didn't even know that I would be learning it. I went there because I wanted to be a better actor. And I knew that my way in to be a better actor was to be more in the moment and less in my head. And I remember thinking to myself, when am I not in my head? And it's when I'm on the dance floor. So it's when I was dancing And I was like, so what other, when do I feel the most free and the most, I don't know, vivacious? And also I thought attractive and compelling. And it was in my body. So I found this physical theater school and I went and lo and behold, in the first year, we go through these units of study. There's commedia with half mask. There was melodrama, not the soap opera type, but the truth in size, large moral stories, stories about morality. And then there was Red Nose Clown. And that was rough. The following year, I learned some more mask work and community-based work and Buffon. And that was the one that was the form that most resonated with me and felt like it was the answer to all the reasons I want to be a person in the theater. Fast forward to teaching at Emerson. And I was planning to teach Buffon there. In fact, I did Buffon for my demo class to get the job. But I don't feel safe teaching Buffon at Emerson because it is a form of satire. And to create the work, we must talk about and laugh openly about things that in my experience of that community, there is no humor about certain things that are going on in society. We're not supposed to be laughing about it. We're not supposed to even be talking about it if we're not in that community. It's very, very, very hard-lined.
It's a fine line to find.
No, it's like really thick, hard walls of no.
And it's hard
I know what you're talking about with Emerson, but in general, it's a fine line to be able to laugh to it, but it's the most radical to be laughing at, you know, major problems and whatnot in society and individually. And some people ought to allow themselves to find that catharsis.
It must be hard though for some college students, especially because, you know, they're trying to figure out who they are too at the same time.
So that led me to return to clown, and it's interesting, you know, there's a phrase I've heard before that to teach is to learn again. And it's been wonderful for me to revisit this material and these lessons and these building blocks for building clown work and finding some love start to emerge, which I hadn't had. I didn't have a healthy relationship with clown. And it's been lovely. And seeing some of the work come out of the classes has been beautiful and delicious. And it's been great.
Because for me, the clown work did the job of kind of opening my comedic brain up to the possibilities of what I could do on stage. Like in my previous training in improv and stage acting and musical theater, you know, they tell you, don't try to be funny. Don't play up the joke. Let it happen naturally. Let it happen through the text don't laugh at your own jokes, which was often a problem that I used to have.
Yeah.
But with your class, who are constantly telling us, be funny all the time, be funny, be funny outward, take everything about you that could be funny and make it funny now.
Like you imitating me with the
joke. Am I wrong?
And I'm like, get now.
Yeah. I mean, you were very adamant about, like, in a healthy way, like I knew you, like, were always looking out for us, but you were trying to make us feel uncomfortable and to push ourselves past the ways that we could be limiting ourselves.
I don't know if it, like, wasn't a conscious effort on in terms of discomfort, although I knew that it's like any growing is going to be in that discomfort, uncomfortable
space.
It was
necessary.
To be vulnerable,
you're making
us uncomfortable at first.
Yeah. I think if I'm remember, like, the things that are, it's interesting to hear it back to me through your lived experience. I think that's so illuminating. I think what I was responding to contextually is, in a lot of actor training, including at Emerson, is this notion of allowing the moment or the truth to just exist. And that's the whole point of performance. And for me, truthfulness is for me the beginning. I'm like, we're supposed to be honest the whole time. And then what? There's going to be an audience there. And I want folks to be dazzled. I want you to like blow these people away. And so I was like, don't sit on your laurels. Don't feel like it's just going to do the job. If you did that perfect little act in rehearsal, you've got to have this awakeness and this vitality and also an openness to mistakes and making them live into gorgeous opportunities at all times, and a deep listening to both your partners, but especially your partner, the audience. So that's what I was like trying to open folks up to. And I think that's what people were feeling.
And sometimes the best mistakes are the ones that like occur on stage. And you're just like, wow, I'm just going to roll with this.
Glorious. Yeah. Yeah. It could be, it's the greatest parts.
And the way you challenged me was kind of forcing me to be subtle, because I have a tendency to overact. I've never had the limitedness of holding myself back on stage. Yeah. And so what with my clown,
honest, Noah.
Yeah, I mean, hey, that's who I am. With my clown, you made me do just the smallest movements in my face. I was kind of my clown was a pig man.
That's right. I remember now.
You remember that?
Yeah.
It was a pig man. And I initially wanted to do this character that was kind of like a piggy king, kind of like a grotesque, like slob. But you kind of shaped me more into a kind of timid, little
pork man.
A little pork man. Who was having to find ways to pop a laugh with moving the side of my lip. Or by adjusting my eye, mm-hmm. and finding comedy in that nuance that wasn't, you know, flailing myself around or going as big as possible, which I had been so used to thinking this is how I get a bigger laugh by going bigger.
Mm-hmm. Wait, do you have clips of this, Noah? Like,
we need video evidence.
We need it on our Instagram page.
We didn't videotape that clown show, did we? I don't think we did.
You're gonna have to bring
if we did, guy. It was against the law, so it never happened. Okay,
oh,
so
yeah, yeah.
Okay, there we go.
But yeah, like it was a total exercise in restraint and intention.
I have to say, okay, so I'm remembering a little bit of that process, and it's unpredictable. Like I couldn't have told you before I started giving you those notes that those were the notes that you needed. What I was doing something that actually is attached to clown itself, which is just listening. Like I would listen to the audience and we would be like not getting the responses you wanted. And I'm like, okay, let me feel chemistry in this room. Like, what is this asking for? And so as an antenna or as a, you know, I was trying to seek out, I had my little antenna out of like what was possible. And I'm like, well, let's go in the opposite direction. Playing the opposite is a classic actor training tool. Mm-hmm. So like, let's try that. And there was this instinct I had that there's so much vibration out of you. You radiate intentionality, you as a performer. And then I was like, I don't think we're going to lose the fullness that's inside of you if it's subtle and you have so much going on. I was like, what if it did more, you allowed it to do more work for you? I think you had a pig nose. And so,
pig nose.
And like, so then we started to play with, it's so grotesque, right? That you were playing with contrasts, which always have this great, wonderful friction for an audience. So subtle movement with a pretty out there grotesque look had this little, I think, comedic friction, and we found some great success in there.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about intentionality in the performance, in your class, you were consistently using the word virtuosic.
Yeah.
When you talked about what you wanted out of performance as a descriptor.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that word means to you?
Yeah. It came out of my training, and you know, I was receiving that word a lot, and you know, on the surface, it means high technical prowess, amazing technical abilities. So it comes out of the circus world, which is where a lot of the clowns get their training. So it's, you know, taking an apparatus and being able to do amazing things and making the audience go ooh and ah. And I brought it into the room. For us, and I know that it has like this sized, there's a connotation to it. It's like, wait, I've got to be epically amazing, but I'm in a class and I'm not epically amazing, I'm learning. So how can I expect that? And so attached to that is the impact of it. That's what I really wanted folks to understand, that the impact of virtuosity on an audience creates that ooh-ah feeling. And the wonderful thing is that attached to that is spectacle. To be able to have someone lean in and just be dazzled. It's very common for circus performers who have an apparatus, have an act for like a 5-minute act with like the silks or something, to put, mm-hmm. you know, when they build the act, the last trick will be one of the most spectacular. It's very, very common that that trick is often not the most difficult. It just looks amazing. It makes the audience applaud. And so I was trying to push folks towards have an expectation, have a want for us to leave the floor hot with your amazing performance, make us go ooh ah, make us want to applaud. So what could seem or feel that way? And mm-hmm. it didn't mean that you needed hours or years of training. It means that it needed to feel like wow. So for example, the three of us right now could create virtuosity if we did something simultaneously. We could probably build it in 3 minutes. But for the audience experiencing it for the first time, us all doing at the same time double take, they would go, ah, and then we would just have a flash of amazingness. And that is an element of virtuosity. Look at that simultaneity, or look at that that physical timing. Build it, put it in like little candy in your act, and makes the audience just love on you and remember you.
So if I was to like have somebody walk into your class and you were like, okay, you're going to create a character, what would you like suggest to them?
Create a character in what context? What's the class? Build a scene for me.
Okay. So like, let's say you're doing clowning, right?
That's
the class that Noah took,
finding
right?
your personal clown.
Yeah, how would you tell someone to create a character using that?
You know, I would start and I don't know if I would think about that end goal because I also treat the class itself in my own teaching like a clown act where you have to be open to possibilities. But I would start saying and create a space where we're all playing, like deeply physical, not really text-based. Play. What is it to have game in our bodies and like sporty fun in our souls? And look for
walk about the space.
Yeah, walk about the space, but which can get really actor training-y and maybe serious, and you know, people zone out.
But adults don't do that normally anymore.
They don't. Know? They don't. And so actor training, all kinds of actor training is really great for, I think, humans. But specific to clown. I would look for where your sense of play is most turned on. You know, mm-hmm. do you like little small stuff, or is it big body stuff? Is it objects? Is it in interaction? Is it solo? Where do you have like the most tickle? And I would have you follow your pleasure, follow your tickle, follow your delight until we start to find something starting to emerge, and then. I just try with costuming, with attitude, I just try to highlight what your starting like point was and build toward that, making it even more pointed.
Yeah, being in the appearance of our own personal clown did a lot to accentuate the naturalness of how easy it came in the movements, in walking around, in having my hair in that weird way, having the nose, having my pants pulled up too high, and whatever that means for the individual performer.
Well, Noah, how did you find your character?
It felt like I was being tested. Mm-hmm. Not like, you know, in a abrasive way, but it felt like I was being pushed out of my comfort zone in ways that like push deeper down into my subconscious even. And thinking of it more deeper than what's going to get the biggest laugh here, into what about me is going to make myself best positioned to get a laugh and get a reaction from the audience.
You're reminding me that a big portion of our class and a big a very common thread through a lot of clown training, although not universal, is the notion of the flop. And you're reminding me that is what's coming up for in terms of discovering your clown. So mm-hmm. the flop being or a simple way to structure that in a class would be, you go behind a flat and I say, you know, enter and make us laugh within the next 3-4 seconds. Yeah. And someone comes out with a big proposal, ha ha, and crickets, nobody laughs. And the rule being to acknowledge that that sucked and exit. And usually what if in the truth of that, in the truth of the flop, which is what that moment is, you turn away and like apologize with your eyes, like, I'm sorry to take your time, I suck. Yeah. And we laugh just like you just did right now. And then if the crowd laughs, you can hear it, look back and stay out. And then people see you coming back and like having, you think I'm funny after all.
Yeah.
And then we might giggle again. And then you try to do something else. You try to tap dance. And then we're thinking that's bad and it's bad. And then you acknowledge that. And sorry. And then we laugh again and back and forth. So the flop energy, the real loss of people's enthusiasm for you, makes us laugh and therefore stay out. And that doesn't feel good. It feels horrible. And yet it is absolutely the center of at least a lot of my clown training.
Yeah, it takes a lot of work to, it's about discovering what it looks like when you're really present on stage.
Yeah.
What it looks like to other people for you to be present.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said something really interesting because like I notice myself, I don't really laugh at like the really big, you know, I'm gonna fall over and everything, but I do laugh at like the really like minute things. And I went to like a reading or a taping, like it was a rehearsal of a taping of a show. And there were people laughing. But there was like one time when I laughed and no one else laughed. And the writers kept that in their thing. And I was like, oh, okay, all right. So I have good humor here.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah, it's when you're caught off guard.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Not, and not, I was like, oh, and not
that
doing
is really brilliant.
Yeah, and not doing, this is going to be funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then you put too much.
Yeah, no one knows I don't laugh at him very often.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will say, ingredients wise, just putting in like the, if you're making a recipe, it really did matter that you tried the big thing. It's context. Right. So like the big thing has to happen. Ha ha. Nobody laughs. Shit. And then they laugh.
Yeah.
They had to have had the big thing before that.
Mm-hmm. A little setup.
A setup.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of doing the big thing that works with audience, with certain audiences and not audiences, I want to ask you about, so the way that your training is impacting me in my life right now is that I am working as a birthday party character performer.
Amazing.
So I am doing Spider-Man and Batman and Darth Vader and all these characters for like 5-year-olds.
Yep.
And performing for 5-year-olds is very different from performing for adults. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that, especially with Spider-Man, who is very physically nimble, very, very active. I'm playing it kind of clowny, but I don't get to use my face. I'm finding a lot of challenges in not only communicating, but popping laughs and making kids laugh without my face.
I saw you, I asked you to send me some topics and questions before this podcast, and I saw that. I was looking forward to this conversation because I'm like, ooh, I have a list of ideas. A couple things. Do they know who Spider-Man is?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I'm a celebrity to them.
Great. So one of the things I use a lot in Buffon work, since it's satire, it's about social recognition of whatever issue is going on, is the notion of iconography. So, you know, Spider-Man's gesture with the webs and
the
like
webs,
the squats poses. With the long leg, all of that, the clarity of that, and I'll use some more technical language from our class, like the fixed point of holding some of those poses can be like gorgeous little candy, like an aha recognition, and you can get some gasps and recognition and yays from your young crowd, I imagine. The other thing, and this again is from our class, that I think that could potentially engage is the notion of status play. And one of the lessons that we talked about in class is status is always given, it's never taken. And so you can make a 5-year-old an amazing, like, powerful villain, or someone who you're trying to obey, or someone who you're trying to defend, and give them all of the status where they can instinctually, physiologically feel that they're being highlighted or lauded or a partner in crime or whatever.
Because I think what people like about what kids resonate with about Spider-Man is that he's a kid like them.
Yeah. He's young. Yeah, he's the youngest.
And what I've found through doing so many of these parties and just like hanging out with 5-year-olds and doing 5-year-old stuff mm-hmm. is that like, for one, that kind of sense of humor has never really left me. But that I'm finding it a lot easier now to just like be a 5-year-old and tap into that.
Yeah.
Because I care a lot more about making them laugh than like being accurate to the movie.
Yep. That's great.
That, cause like if I worked at Disneyland, I'd have to adhere a lot more to the details of that, which is just really cumbersome and doesn't make it fun. But yeah, like yes anding kids in has been the craziest improv training without being on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And because, yeah, I definitely consider myself more like clowny Spider-Man. I'm doing pratfalls. I'm doing the moves wrong, per se, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and like letting them correct me.
I love that. That's great.
But yeah, like it's been a total exercise. Like I want to take another class in clowning just so I can get more acquainted with all the aspects of my body that aren't my face mm-hmm. and that aren't speech.
Yeah.
Would you do it with a mask on then? If you were practicing?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Cause like Darth Vader is uh-huh. very, is a very different character that has very different physicality.
Yep.
And that one you get, it's fun to play. I mean, Darth Vader is the Lord of the galaxy. He's the biggest, most evilest, number one high status villain probably ever. And when I'm with 5-year-olds to kind of diffuse the situation, some of them are scared of me, but some of them, it's fun to play low status as Darth mm-hmm. Vader because what I know they want to do is best me.
Yes.
They want to conquer me in ways beyond, you know, hitting me with a lightsaber.
So have they knocked you over and like stood on you before as Darth Vader?
No, I mean, it's not, I mean, yes, I do get physically beat up a lot at these parties, but the play with status is fun in kind of, because what the kids want to feel like they're smarter than you.
Mm.
They want to feel like they know more or that they are at least on the level. Like they know, like they want to be taken seriously,
mm-hmm.
but they don't like to be talked down to.
And kids are smart.
Yeah, and especially with villains and whatnot, they want to feel like they're making you look silly.
The other thing I would say for this age group is that you do have control over in terms of physicality is, and this gets really into the weeds of like, training, but is your spine, because it's a skin tight suit, yeah. So your silhouette is like very visible. Your profile is very visible. And so I would, and this also comes out of puppetry. I was, in my puppetry training, they said, if you're finding using found objects to make your puppet and you can only make it have one joint because of just all the pieces, make sure that you prioritize the breath joint, which is right right at the chest. Mm-hmm. So that the puppet can look like it's inhaling and exhaling.
Yeah.
So you can deflate and fill in. And so if it's where the biggest like highs and lows of emotion can be expressed. So if your Spider-Man is worried or deflated or doesn't get a reaction, you can just like pow with the spine and then get power again and follow your beat. It's all in here and here and here. And then really articulately. So if it's fuzzy, then you might not be telling the story clearly. So articulate, spine work, and you might be telling the stories that you want to tell.
Yeah, like conveying emotion with the body in a cartoony way.
Yeah, it is. It is. It goes in that direction.
Because the 5-year-olds I'm working with, they love Spider-Man, but they haven't seen the big blockbuster movies.
Right.
They haven't seen Tom Holland. They haven't seen Avengers. They've seen Spidey and the Amazing Team, which is the Disney Junior show with like,
or Teen Titans.
With like, small little 3D animated cartoons that look like toys.
Yeah.
And so behaving more like a toy is very different from behaving like Tom Holland or like, a Hollywood superhero.
Yeah.
It's I've definitely learned a lot about acting in my own body, mm-hmm. and different ways to pop a laugh. And also just like the big differences between 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds.
Huge,
and
like what, layers
and
of
what they
yeah.
like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. For sure. For sure.
Because awesome. Yeah. Like I yesterday I had a Spider-Man party in a bowling alley.
Yeah, you did.
And so there was like no room to do anything. I couldn't run around. I couldn't play red light, green light.
You couldn't like slide on the
did you bowl?
Alleys.
I did a little bowling. Yeah. I couldn't slide on my belly down the alleys. Yeah. There was a lovely moment where it was one of the kids was not strong enough to roll the ball all the way down the lane, so it stopped halfway through, but then it started rolling back, and we had to like act like we were webbing it back.
Yes,
it was a great moment of play.
That's great. That's so great.
But yeah, like I've gotten to the point where I can kind of, I know what to say mm-hmm. and how to do all the kind of the structured content of it with the games and whatnot, but. Just the hanging outness of it all is just as important, and having little interactions with kids and kind of, because especially with Spider-Man, where it's a character who you can't see my face, it's a little scary at first to some kids. Sure. I need to disarm them and say, hey, I'm silly. I'm not scary.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. That's a great job. That's so fun. You learn a lot.
Yeah. It's the weirdest kind of acting training, but I'm definitely going to look back on it years and in the future.
Yeah, when you're big, you'll be like, yeah. Yes, I used to.
Yes, when I'm the real Spider-Man.
Hey, why not?
Yeah. All right, let's move on to some quick hitters, lightning round type stuff.
Okay.
Can you tell us in your definition, what's the difference between laugh with and laugh at? Because I know that you are always harping on the audience is laughing at you.
Yeah. I just think it's about who's in on the joke. If we're laughing at anything, that means it's often the case that the figure or figures that we're laughing at are not in on the joke. They didn't mean to be funny. They didn't know that the thing that just happened was supposed to make people laugh. And laughing with is collective recognition that thing that we all experienced is funny and we all laugh. I think it's that question. If you put that figure of speech, who is in on the joke and who is not, then you'll figure out if it's at or with.
Yeah. It was a quick way to break down our egos to be like, they're going to laugh at you. Yeah. Yes. You are the joke.
You are the object.
Yeah. You're the object. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, often what comes up is people trying to do a funny thing and I'm like, right. No, you are the funny thing. Like, it's you. Sorry about it, but that's what's happening.
There's something about everyone that you can laugh at.
Yeah, but there's people who, no, I'd say most people really work to avoid being the object of laughter. So it's a real subversion of your natural instincts, of natural social instincts.
You know, you said that you did theater back in the day. What is your favorite show or musical?
Not back in the day. I do theater now. My favorite written play is The Goat or Who is Sylvia by Edward
Albee. Oh my god, I had to do a monologue for that from that show for drama camp one summer. Mm-hmm. And I need to see that whole play because it is some messed up source material.
It is so amazing. I love it. I love it. I saw it on Broadway. I've seen it in LA. It's just a divine structured, great, great social commentary. It's amazing.
I had to do the monologue where it was the guy's son realizing, you're fucking a goat.
Yep.
Like that whole kind of realization and letting that kind of emotion of shock and disdain fall over me in ways that I never thought to experience before, because it was such a stark. I mean, it's about a man who's in love with a goat.
Yes, having an affair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. I gotta finish. Do I? I think I might even.
Oh,
I might even have it.
And
are you gonna get a
reading
from it?
And
oh, tonight, I have it here. Of the role of Billy will be played by Noah Bender.
That's right. Yeah, we're doing a reading right now. You didn't know that. Here we are.
Yeah, I got to finish it.
So good.
What's the worst crowd you've ever performed for?
Funny enough, it's fellow acting and comedy teachers.
That makes sense.
It's just, I feel like they must be saturated or something, but it is not a great group of people to perform for.
Don't, you know what, also anywhere.
I know, I think the other thing is performing for people with masks on. This is during COVID era.
Oh yeah.
Since so much, as you know, Noah, the work is based off of listening to and perceiving the crowd's temperature, I'm pretty lost. I mean, I see it in the eyes, I see it in the cheeks coming over, I hear it sometimes in laughter if I'm doing comedy, but you can't always.
Yeah.
And it's a real barrier.
It's same hard thing to with tell where people are laughing from too. You know, like you hear laughter and then you're like, where?
What's happening? Yeah.
Because it's such a two-way interaction.
It is. And it's subtle. Like it's human. Like I'm looking at your whole, the face composition and knowing like where you are with me, if you're being put off, if you're distrustful, if all the things. So yeah, all that. Thank you for that, Noah.
Yeah. That was me being put off.
Yes. Yes. Oh, ooh, nice.
Okay. We're getting faces.
Oh, my word.
Your pearls.
I know.
And the final question that we ask of every guest on the Theater World podcast is, can you remember the greatest experience you've ever had at the theater, either as an audience or performer?
The one that comes to the top of mind is a night of doing Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And I remember the audience. I remember some of my castmates had said, hey, just so you know, there's someone with a wheelchair who's kind of on the stage because of accessibility. That's the only spot for that person. It's proscenium stage. And I was like, whatever, it's no big deal. But every night when I did the What a Piece of Work is a Man speech, I would usually highlight or take part of it to someone in that area. That night, this person was was diminutive and had maybe, I'm not sure what all they were dealing with physically, but they were in a wheelchair, mechanical wheelchair, and they're in part of the light because they have a large wheelchair. And I take the speech, I start doing it. I already talk about how, you know, I've lost all my mirth. It's a hard scene already. And then when I look out of the audience, I remember putting my hand out. It was in the light. It was like, whoosh, cast of light. And I put my hand out, just put it out before I started the speech. And he puts his hand out and puts it right on mine. And we are holding hands. And the audience is like pin drop silent. And I said, what a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason. Everything about the absolute paragon of all animals, of all of creation, for someone who is very likely to have lived a life where that is not possibly what society thinks of this person.
Right.
Yeah.
And the audience and myself, and I've never lived a speech, I never lived a text and had it resonate so fully in my own body. And this person's taking of it, resonance with it, and then the audience was, palm of my hand, you know, that whole ego massage of that, and it lifted the whole room. It was just beautiful, and I don't think I was doing any of the work. It was just the truth of the words.
Yeah, a moment of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what an unexpected way to like elevate the text.
Yeah.
In ways that you never considered.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Wow, very special.
Yeah,
thanks profound. For sharing.
Absolutely, it was my pleasure.
Well, thank you so much, Natty, for coming on our podcast.
Yeah,
that's so cool. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we had so much fun talking clown, talking Buffon, talking.
Maybe I'll have to create somebody character sometime now.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I do kind of have somebody nicknamed Carol Channing that comes out every now and then. But
love it.
Yes. Does Carol have a question?
Oh, she might.
Oh, no. Yes.
Hi, everyone. Carol. Hi, how are you?
I'm well. It's great to meet you. I'm a huge fan of your work.
Oh, thank you so much. I was actually taking a nap while you guys were all interviewing, but someone had to wake me up.
I'm so sorry about that. Your hair still looks amazing.
Oh, thank you. I didn't comb it or anything. I don't really have a question, but I loved your interview, and I'll watch your videos. Those were so fun.
Thank you. Wow, I'm so honored.
Thanks, Carol. All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Dolly. Goodbye. All right. Well, Nettie, do you have anything you want to plug or point us to?
Did you just say goodbye, Dolly?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. goodbye, Dolly.
And she's kind of a Dolly herself. Yeah,
she is.
Naked Empire Buffon Company. Naked Empire Buffon Company. My company is thriving, and we happen to be, we're coming out, it's Pride Month, we're coming out as bi-coastal, because we have, we have shows in two festivals on two coasts, so we have a show that we created last year called The Most Important Place in the World, that'll be at the Cannonball Festival, it's associated with the Philly Fringe in Philadelphia, also in September, so two festivals, two shows. I directed and co-created both of them, and I'm performing in the Philly one.
Awesome. Oh,
that's awesome, too.
Are you still teaching in Emerson, too?
I am, yeah.
Great. Well, this was a blast to reconnect with you.
Thanks so much, and it's so nice My to pleasure. Meet you.
Likewise. It's a pleasure. I really feel honored. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, this has been the Theater World Podcast. I'm Noah.
And I'm Zandra.
And we will see you next time. Bye-bye. Bye.